Pictures of bodies never bothered me, she said. I worked in the funeral home for 30 years and saw everything you can see. Virgil nodded and took out the color Xerox of the woman on the table. He handed it to Gerald Johnstone, who looked at it with his vague eyes, focused, and then seemed to shudder with recognition. He said, "That looks like our funeral home. This is a funeral home in the picture, and it looks like our dressing table. But I can't say that I remember the case. It appears to be an automobile accident, is what I'd say. We had lots of those. Didn't have full funerals. Just dress the body and ship it back to wherever they came from. So, I can't remember." Virgil thought, "He's lying." Carol was shaking her head. "I'd remember if I'd seen it, but I never saw it. Where did it come from?" "I don't know," Virgil said. "I was hoping you could tell me." She shook her head. "I was there, but I never saw that woman. Must have been a dress and ship. Whoever she isn't local." "Okay," Virgil said. Gerald Johnstone was still peering at the picture, replaying something in his mind. But again he shook his head. "I'm sorry," he said. Carol Johnstone, Virgil thought, was telling the truth. Gerald Johnstone was lying through his teeth. He pushed the old man. "It's important that we know if it's your place or not," he said. "Is it your funeral home?"
"It could be," Johnstone said. "But the way the picture is, it's too close up. The table is the same kind we had, a stainless steel Furno. We don't have it anymore."
Carol Johnstone said, "That is our place, Jerry, before the remodel." She tapped one corner of the photo, the corner of an odd machine that looked like an oversized blender. "That's the old port-a-boy, remember? I'm sure that's our place." Gerald Johnstone shook his head.
"I think it is, but I don't remember the case. We did hundreds of automobile accidents over the years, and I'm just too old."
Still lying, Virgil thought.
"When did you do the remodel?" he asked.
"That was 1981 into 1982. All new equipment by 1982, Carol Johnstone said. "Whoever that is had to be killed before that. But the table and the port-a-boy go way back, before our time."
Virgil asked, "What about the man in the moon?"
Knew he'd taken a misstep. They were both mystified and showed it. Carol said, "What?"
"Betsy Carlson said something about the man in the moon, that she'd seen the man in the moon. Seemed to think there might be a connection."
Carol shook her head, but again Virgil thought he saw a spark in Gerald's eye. Virgil said, "She told me Jerry was there for the man in the moon. Jerry knew about it." Carol was shaking her head, but Gerald's eyes drifted away as he said,
"It's a complete mystery. What does it mean?"
Virgil, looking directly at Gerald Johnstone, said, "If you remember anything, you let me know. You called this killer a nutcase, and that's the exact truth of the matter. Keep your doors locked. If he thinks you might be involved in whatever's going on, you're both at some risk."
Carol Johnstone said suddenly, "This will sound silly."
"Tell me," Virgil said.
"The night the Gleasons were killed, we weren't here. We're here 250 nights a year. We have a place in Palm Springs where we go in the winter. But that was one night we weren't. We were in Minneapolis, visiting our daughter and seeing a show. When we came back the next day, there were police all over the street."
"Oh, this is nothing," Gerald Johnstone said. "I'd like to hear it anyway," Virgil said.
Carol nodded. "Anyway, we stopped and found out from one of the deputies what happened, and Larry Jensen came over and interviewed us, but we didn't have anything to tell him. We were gone. But when we first came in the door, the welcome mat was moved."
"Oh, Carol," the old man said, rolling his eyes.
"Well, it was," she said. "You know how I like everything neat, and it was off to the side of the door. I thought then that somebody moved it. Well, the Gleasons were killed in the middle of the night, and we were back at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so who moved it?"
"You think that whoever killed the Gleasons?"
She shivered. "They were right there, down the street. We have timers on our lights, so it looks like somebody's home, lights going off and on. Maybe...
He looked directly at Johnstone. If you remember anything, you tell me. We don't want somebody else to die.
I'll think as hard as I can, he said.
If it turns out you're lying to me, you could spend the rest of your life in prison as an accomplice.
Carol got hot. Hey, he's not lying. We'd do anything to catch this monster.
I'm just saying, Virgil said. He left them at that. Interesting that Gerald Johnstone should be lying. He needed to track down the photo, and then he needed to come back and pound on Johnstone. As he got back in the truck, he thought about the welcome mat being moved. Sighed, dug his pistol out from under the car seat and clipped it to his belt. He drove back across the coulee, went to the newspaper, and found Williamson sitting at his computer writing. He looked up when Virgil came through the door.
Hell of a story on the layman's, he said. I owe you a large one.
You hear anything new on the Schmidts?
No, damn it, if they were going to get killed, I wish they hadn't done it on the day the paper comes out. We won't be able to print a word for a week. In the meantime, we're getting eaten alive by the Globe and the Argus Leader.
The Globe and the Argus Leader were the dailies in Worthington and Sioux Falls.
You can pay me right now for the one you owe me, Virgil said. He looked at his watch, 2:15. I'd like to see the papers from 1969.
Williamson said, We don't have them that way, not whole papers. Back before 1995, they're on microfilm, and they have them at the library.
If you have a name, it'd be in the clip file?
Virgil shook his head. No name. I don't even know what I'm doing. Where's the library?
Just up the hill.
Are you going to the press conference?
Wouldn't miss it for the world, Virgil said.
Neither would anybody else in town. I don't know what Stryker's going to do. People are already starting to crowd into the courtroom. Won't be room for the reporters.
Virgil hustled up to the library, a flat red brick building on the corner of Main Street. Inside, a pale-eyed, blonde librarian with the smooth skin of an eighth grader took him to a microfilm booth at the back of the stacks.
I'll show you how to thread the microfilm. It can be a trial, she said.
She went to a wooden file cabinet with dozens of small drawers, muttered, 1969. She pulled it open, took four boxes of microfilm out and handed them to Virgil, then went back to the file and said,
Darn it, we're missing a box. Somebody has misfiled it.
He was interested.
Which box?
She started sorting through them again, explaining, We don't start a new drawer until the last drawer is full, and when I opened it, it was loose. So there's a box up somewhere. It looks like...
She stood on her tiptoes, pushed her glasses up her nose, looking into the drawer, and finally said,
We stop at the middle of May and start again in September. So one box is missing. We have 4 months in each roll.
Darn. I tell people to leave the refiling to us, but they don't listen.
Could it be misfiled? Virgil asked.
She pulled open a drawer from the '90s that was only partially full of microfilm boxes. Checked them, said, These are all right. Then went through a bunch of empty drawers at the bottom of the case. She said,
I think it's been taken by somebody. I'll check these after we close. I have to work the desk. But I think it's been taken.
I'd appreciate it if you'd check, Virgil said.
The missing box intrigued him. The librarian showed him how to thread the film they had, and he looked at 4 months around Schmidt's mortgage loan, and in the quick review saw nothing that struck him. No strange women in automobile accidents. Not enough to work with. Not yet. And it was possible that Judd had simply bought Schmidt to be used as necessary. Virgil was out the library door at 3:20. By 3:10, he'd changed into a pale blue shirt with a necktie, khaki slacks, and a navy blue sport coat. Looking at himself in the mirror, he decided he looked like a greeter at a minor Indian casino. He got back to the courthouse at 3:01. 20 people were standing outside the courthouse door, mostly older, mostly men,
mostly deep in conversation. Two television remote trucks were parked on the lawn, cables snaking through the doors of the courthouse. Inside was chaos. The courtroom might take 100 people if nobody breathed too hard. In addition to two TV cameramen who'd rigged lights over an attorney's table that had been dragged in front of the judge's bench, there were two on-camera people, both women, four tired-looking men and two tired-looking women who were probably from newspapers, two guys with tape recorders who might be from radio stations, and about 100 locals who weren't going anywhere. Virgil stuck his head inside, took it all in, then headed down the hall to Stryker's office before he attracted any attention. His phone went off and he pulled it out of his pocket. Stryker. He buzzed past the secretary, stuck his head into Stryker's office and said, "Yo." Stryker hung up the phone. "Where in the hell have you been?"
"Running around,"
Virgil said. "Do you know what you're going to say?"
"Well,"
Stryker shrugged, "tell the truth, I guess."
"Jesus, Jim, you can't do that."
Virgil looked around, saw the secretary watching, and closed the office door on her.
"It'd stop us in our tracks.
Maybe if you'd been here an hour ago, we could have cooked something up."
"There's no cooking,"
Virgil said. "You go out there, you give them the gory details of the three scenes. Gleason, Judd, and Schmidt. Everybody local already knows about them, so you're not giving anything away. Talk about them being shot in the eyes. Talk about Judd being burned right down to the ankle bones. TV people will like that. Tell them that we've developed information that would suggest that the killer is local, and that we've come up with a number of leads that we can't talk about, but that if they come back in a week or 10 days, we believe that we'll have a lot more, that we're rolling."
"Are we?"
Stryker asked.
"Kind of."
"Virgil?"
"You don't tell them what it is, dummy,"
Virgil said. "That's the confidential part. We're rolling, but we can't talk about it."
"If I do that, and if I don't come up with something in 10 days, I am truly screwed."
"If you go out there and say we ain't got jack shit, you're truly screwed anyway," Virgil said. "If you go out and say the hounds of hell are on the killer's heels, maybe he'll make a move that we can see."
"Mother of God.
She ain't here, Jim. It's just you and me." Stryker straightened himself out, and as they were about to go out, asked, "How much detail?"
"More than you think you should. The eyes, and the fact that it seems to be a ritual, the stick that propped up Schmidt, facing toward the east, that Gleason was propped up facing the east. There was nothing left of Judd but his ankle and wrist bones, and the wire from his heart. They'll eat that up."
"I'm going to need some heart work," Stryker said. "Honest to God, I'm going to need some heart work."
At the last minute, walking down the hall, Virgil whispered, "You're the grim sheriff of a rural county. You're an honest, upright, tight-jawed, God-fearing cowboy. You don't want to talk about it, but you think you should, because we're in a democracy. You're grim. You don't smile because the dead people are friends. This guy is killing your people."
"Grim," Stryker said.
He was, and he pulled it off, barely moving his jaws. Virgil said 32 words. "We're working on it hard, and like the sheriff says, we're rolling. But the BCA's position is that the sheriff runs the operation, and we let him do the talking for us." A woman from a television station in Sioux Falls liked Stryker a lot, got tight with him, pushed him a little. "What are you going to do when you catch this guy?" she asked.
"Gonna hope that the son of a bitch fights back," Stryker said, his face like a rock. "Save the state some trial money."
They didn't even cut the son of a bitch. Afterwards, in Stryker's office, Virgil told him the truth.
"I think you did it."
"So we got 10 days or 2 weeks." He took a turn around his office.
"What'd you think about the chick from Sioux Falls?"
"If Jesse doesn't work out, give her a call," Virgil said. "She had a nice bodice." Made Virgil laugh. The TV people were packed up and gone by 4:30, leaving behind a crowd of locals who were dissipating like the fizz on a hot Coke. Virgil picked up the box lunch at Earnhardt's and called Joan.
"You ready?"
"Not until after the news." Virgil went back to the motel, peed, put on a cowboy shirt and running shoes, let the shirt hang outside his pants to cover the pistol.
On the way to Jones' house, he dialed Sandy, Davenport's research assistant. How we doing with the tax returns?
I've got them stacked up to my elbows, she said.
I talked to Lucas, and I'm sending them down there with a messenger. He'll leave here tomorrow at 8. You should have him by noon.
Terrific. Get me one more set of records if you can. Carol and Gerald Johnstone, both of Bluestem, owners or former owners of the Johnstone Funeral Home.
They'll be in the package, she said.
Also, check with the State Historical Society and see if they have copies of the Bluestem Record newspaper for the months of May through September, 1969.
I couldn't do that today. They'll be closed, Sandy said.
Tomorrow I won't be here, and then there's the weekend. I could see if I could find somebody else.
Oh, boy, Virgil said.
Okay, Monday first thing?
First thing. He described the dead woman on the table, told her she might have been an auto accident victim.
If I find anything, I'll fax it to the motel, she said.
No, no, call me on my cell. You can read it to me. I don't want to give this away.
Chapter 11. The news was just coming up when Virgil knocked on Joan's front door. She shouted,
"Come on in,"
and he went through into her living room.
"Did you see me at the press conference?"
"No."
"I got crushed," Joan said. "I was in the back, and this fat guy from the Firestone store, I got welded to his butt.
Here we go."
The press conference was the lead story and sucked up 4 or 5 minutes of the broadcast. Virgil had been right about the details. They loved it. And the cameras loved Stryker's face and the tight jaws.
"That's my brother," Joan said, delighted when it was over. "He looked like a movie star."
"He was good," Virgil said.
"You've been holding out on me, too," Joan said.
She'd stacked a duffel bag near the front door and picked it up on the way out.
"You never told me that you guys were rolling. You've been all downbeat."
"Yeah, well," he mumbled.
"What?"
"Nothing," Virgil said.
"What'd you say?"
"They'd just gotten into the truck.
You said something."
He leaned over, kissed her on the cheek, and said,
"It's all bullshit. We got nothing."
She was flabbergasted.
"Virgil?"
"That's the way it is."
"Virgil?"
"We got 10 days.
He backed out of the driveway, and she didn't say another word until they were out of town.
Then, "Did you bring the food?"
"Exactly what you ordered," Virgil said.
"You got nothing?"
"Well, maybe something."
"Virgil!"
He then fumbled behind the seat in his briefcase and hooked out one of the color Xeroxes and passed it to her. She recoiled.
"Yuck!"
"Any idea who it is?"
"Probably before your time, though."
"No. Where'd you find this?" she asked.
"In Roman Schmidt's safe deposit box. Nothing but the photograph. No other paper that might suggest what it is. I have a feeling that it's before the middle of 1969.
"Did you look in the paper?"
"The paper's on microfilm in the library," he said. "Somebody stole a roll from the middle of 1969, but there's no way to know if that's the one we're looking for."
"Really?"
"Virgil, you may..."
She hesitated then. "Does Jim know about this?"
"Not yet. I'm going to tell him when I see him, but I think he might be out of town at the moment," Virgil said.
"Out of town? He can't be," she said.
"What else happened?"
He grinned. "I swore I wouldn't tell anyone."
"I don't care. Tell me anyway."
Virgil laughed and said, "I think he's taken Jesse Lehman out to dinner, someplace far away where nobody'll see him, because he's supposed to be working on the Roman Schmidt case night and day, even if there's nothing to do."
"Oh, my God," she pulled her bottom lip.
"Well, I hope he gets laid, and if he does, I hope it's worth it, because he really is in trouble here, Virgil. I wouldn't be surprised if one of the Curleys declares that he's running for sheriff one of these days."
"You think?"
"Big Curley thought he was the natural successor to Roman Schmidt. He might be past it now, but little Curley would take the job in a minute."
"Neither one of them struck me as a wizard," Virgil said.
"No, but their families have been here forever. They know everyone. They slapped every back in the county. And they're fairly good-natured. If Jim really slips, one of them will run." We'll get the guy. Next week or so, Virgil said.
You think?
Yep. Will anybody else be killed? She asked. He had to think for a minute, then said, Maybe.
Joan made him park the truck in the barn, a gesture toward discretion, and then they walked through the low weeds to the creek and up the path into the Striker's Dell. The running shoes made the going easier. Cowboy boots weren't made for climbing rocks. At the top, on the left side of the pond, Joan opened the duffel and took out a quilt.
Straight from Walmart.
Mix the rocks softer, she said. Virgil unloaded the food and beer, and when he looked up, she was unbuttoning her blouse. He squatted on the rock, watching as she took it off, slipped out of her shoes, socks, and jeans, popped the brassiere, tossed it with the other clothes, and slipped out of her underpants.
See anything you like?
Well, yeah, he said. Last one in, she said, and she was over the side of the rock, 6 feet into the water, and Virgil was shedding shoes, shirt, and pants as quickly as he could get them off. 15 seconds after she went over the side, he followed, the water a bracing slap. When he came up, she was there to push his head back under. They played around the pool for a few minutes, laughing and sputtering, the water cool but not cold, refreshing in the summer heat, and the stones in the direct light of the setting sun were warm as toast. The pool's back wall to the east, where the spring came down, had eroded into a steep ramp. At the top of the ramp was a finger of dirt and grass, and beyond it, a rocky hillside running up to the crest. The pool walls on the north and south sides went straight up, 40 feet or so, solid red rock. A local kid had once jumped off the top on a dare, Joan said, had landed in not quite the deepest part, and had broken a couple of foot bones when he hit bottom.
That was the end of that, she said. We had to carry him out.
The west side was the canyon, with the sun setting right in the center of the slot. It did that in May and August, she said, then swung farther north and south, depending on the season. They were facing each other, blowing water. Virgil working on a new game. He had a handful of her pubic hair, and her two hands were on his chest, and he was about to suggest a different move when he caught the reflection up the hillside, beyond the head of the pool. He thought it might be water on an eyelash, a refraction off a splash, something else. But then he caught it again, and he pushed her head under water and ducked under himself, caught her arm, and dragged her deeper toward the head of the pool. She struggled against him, but he pulled hard until he felt the east wall, and then they rose 2 feet to the surface, and she shouted, Virgil! Virgil, what are you doing? A frightened tone threaded in her voice as she shook water away from her face. Virgil shoved her against the wall and said urgently, There's somebody on the hillside above us. I saw a reflection off glass, off a lens. She turned to look, but they were out of the line, against the face.
What?
Somebody up the hill.
A camera?
Could be a camera, Virgil said.
What else?
Could be a scope, he said. When somebody's looking at you with glasses, you can usually see their arms. She looked at him shocked, then looked at their clothes.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You're sure?
She asked, craning her neck to look overhead.
I saw it twice.
He looked back at their clothes and then said, I want you to stay right here. I'm going underwater to that corner right there. I'm going to come out fast. I don't think he's at least a couple of 100 yards away, maybe 300. I don't think he can get me if I'm moving fast. Once I'm behind that lip, I can get to the clothes, get my gun. I started carrying it today. Tell you later. Now, stay here. I'm going. He took 2 deep breaths. Then pushed himself straight down the wall. Had to go deep because the water was clear. When he hit bottom, he oriented himself, pushed off the wall, kept thinking, stay deep, stay deep. Felt the bottom shelving. Came up slightly offline. Surged forward with a butterfly stroke, lurching toward a groove in the rock, and was almost there, almost in, when there was a slap on the wall to the right. One hand slipped, and down he went, lurched again. Slipping, and then he was into the groove, hurting, registering the crack of a rifle shot. Pushed himself up the groove, skinning his knees, crawled up behind the wall, 6 feet from his weapon. Jones shouted, "Virgil, he's shooting! Virgil!"
Not hit, he thought. Everything's still working. He looked back at the wall and could see the pockmark where the slug had hit, 2 feet above where his head had been. Not that close, but close enough to scare him. He shouted back to Joan,
"I'm okay. You stay there."
He started counting. 1 minute. 1 minute, 30 seconds. Joan made a questioning gesture, and he put up a finger. "Wait." 2 minutes. When he'd hunt deer up north, and he'd see a buck threading through the trees, he could focus on any given shot for a minute or two. After that, he'd lose precise focus. He'd trained himself to wait until the deer was right down a shooting lane before he even started to focus, because 2 minutes were a long time to concentrate on a shot. 2 minutes, 20 seconds, and he coiled himself against the wall, spotted his pistol, said to himself, "Go, go, go," and he went. 6 feet out, half a second, get the gun, 6 feet back. The incoming slug was just that fraction of a second too slow, slapping off the rock a yard wide and again too high. He had the gun. He stood, popped his head out for a half second, pulled back, dropped to his knees, popped his head out again, saw movement, like a bear, somebody in dark clothes near the crest, running toward the crest, away from them. He pulled back, stood, turned around the corner, braced himself on the rock, aimed the pistol 5 or 6 feet high, and started pulling the trigger, counting out 7 shots. He had no idea how much elevation he needed at 400 yards, but it'd be a lot. The pistol shot almost 5 inches low at 100 yards. If he hit something, the chances of which were vanishingly small, that was all to the good. Mostly, he wanted a bunch of slugs flying around the guy like bees. Because, he thought, the guy couldn't take the slightest chance of getting hit. If he was hit, or even seen, he was done. So, a stalemate. Virgil was down in the pool, without any way of going after the guy. But Virgil was also armed and wary, down among the jumble of rocks, and would be hard to get at. Virgil stood next to the wall, ready to take cover, and watched, and saw nothing more. Finally, he shouted at Joan,
"Underwater, just like I did, into that groove. He's not there anymore, but don't take any chances. Get out of there, quick."
She nodded, pushed herself under, and a few seconds later surfaced and crawled into the groove across the rock, and then stood up next to him.
"Now what?"
She shivered. She'd been in the cool water too long. "Now I do this for a couple more minutes, and then I grab the clothes.
Virgil, I'm about 99% sure he's gone. He can't be seen. You can hear that rifle for a mile or more, and it's not hunting season. He's got to move. He's got to get out of here.
Probably go straight north on Holman. There's nothing there before you hit Highway 7. Once he's on 7, he's just another car."
"Then that's probably it," Virgil said. And he thrust himself away from the wall, grabbed the clothes, and was back.
He handed her her bra and blouse, then pushed her back against the wall and kissed her and said,
"Getting shot at makes me horny."
"And your penis is about a half inch long. Cold water does it every time. It's sort of a tragedy, isn't it?"
Virgil looked down at himself and said, "That wasn't the cold water, sweetheart. That was fear, pure and simple."
He stepped back, looking up the hill. If he'd been cool about it, he could have slipped up close. We'd be playing in the pool, and bang, he could have done both of us.
She leaned out from the wall and asked, "I wonder why he didn't."
"He might have been planning to, but he stopped to look things over with the scope. That's when I saw him. I think he wanted to wait until we were out of the water so he could get a full body shot. But he got impatient and stopped to look us over." They were dressing as they talked. When they were done, Virgil said, "I'll get the stuff."
"Fuck the stuff," she said.
"He's gone," Virgil said. "He's gone. But we stay close to the wall anyway. If there's any other place he'd wait,
It'd be while we're coming out of the mouth of the canyon.
Virgil popped out again, grabbed the food, and jumped back. Then out again, snagged Joan's duffel, and hopped back. Never exposed for more than a second. Time enough for a snapshot, but not a good one. Not if the shooter couldn't anticipate the move. When they were ready, Virgil said, "Squeeze in close to the wall, and when we have to show ourselves, move fast. One at a time. You first." 50 feet back into the canyon, they were protected. They stopped, and Joan used the quilt to wash the blood off Virgil's face. "You've got 5 small cuts." She traced them with her index finger on his temple and cheek. "I don't think stitches, but you could use some band-aids." "Got some in the truck." At the mouth of the canyon, an obvious ambush spot, they sat, watched, and finally made the move, running one at a time past the stock tank, crouched through the weeds behind the barn. Breathing hard, Joan said, "That's a heck of a fourth date. I don't think you've got a reasonable encore." The barn was going dark as the sun went down. Virgil got a box of shells from the truck and reloaded the magazine for the pistol, the shells clicking into place. When he was finished, he opened the back hatch, lifted the concealment cover, took out a shotgun and a box of shells, loaded the shotgun. Joan said, "It was you he wanted." "I think so. He's getting tired of my act." "That's a relief," she said. "At least I'm safe." He laughed. "Yeah. Listen, about that short penis thing. It's not your fault." "It's not that. I just wish you'd use some other word than penis, you know. Sounds too much like peanut." He finished loading the shotgun and pumped a shell into the chamber and put it between the front truck seats. "Why don't you say dick? That'd be good." "Seems crude." "Whatever." He stepped away from the truck and looked up at the overhead light. "Does that light come on when the barn door goes up?" "Yes." "It'll silhouette us. I'll get it." He took off his shoes and climbed up on the hood of the truck, and then on the roof, reached up and unscrewed the light bulb, left it hanging by a thread. Punched the door lift, just enough to turn on the light. She punched the lift button, and the light bulb remained dark. "When I say to lift the door, lift it. Then climb in the back seat, get down low, and hang on. I'm getting out of here." He climbed into the truck, started the engine, and braced the shotgun, muzzle down, between the passenger side floor and seat. "Punch the button. Get in." She did, and he watched the door going up, seeming to take an eternity. Then he hit the gas, and the truck blew through the opening backwards, and he kept it moving backwards in a circle around the parking lot, jabbed the brake, jammed the shift into drive, and tore down the short driveway to the county road. Skidded onto the road with a quick brake and another pulse of acceleration, and they were gone. "We okay?" Joan asked. "Yeah, he's long gone. But we're so far away from help that we didn't dare take the chance." He drove past the hill, away from town. "Where are we going?" Joan asked. "Got some people to talk to." He slowed, pulled over, and said, "Let me get rid of the shotgun. You can ride up front." They stopped at 5 farms along Highway 7 and spoke to one guy mowing a ditch. Who had they seen on the highway? Shrugs and shaken heads. Nobody in particular. On the way back to town, Virgil said, "I thought everybody knew everybody else's car." "Not out here, in town. If it had been something unusual, like a Toyota or a Mercedes, somebody might have noticed. But a Ford or a Chevy, unless there's a sign on it." Virgil didn't write much that night. He was stuck on story development. Homer was pissed off and scared. The killer was coming after him. Time to let somebody know about that, file a report. But the man in the moon. He spent some time considering it. Thought about Jesse Lehman's moon earrings. Those had a man in the moon. But Homer didn't think Betsy would be talking about a symbol. She was talking about a man. And Homer thought about the new moon coming up as he was driving into the thunderstorm on the way to Bluestem, the crescent moon in his rearview mirror. Could the moon be triggering this guy? A new moon? Huh. The moon came up in the east,
just like the sun did. Were Gleason and Schmidt propped up facing the east because that was where the moon came from? Facing the moon, but not allowed to see it? Crazy talk. Before going to sleep, Homer thought about the shooting that afternoon. Scary, but the guy had missed. Could have gotten a lot closer. Did the shooter intend to kill, or only to frighten? If only to frighten, why? Virgil went to sleep hoping that Homer would come up with an idea, because at this point, Virgil himself had none at all. Went to sleep dreaming of Joni Stryker on the rock at the Dell. Chapter 12. Virgil opened his eyes. Daylight. He felt good, but a little stiff from sleeping on the floor. Worried about the gunman, he'd taken the cushions off the couch and had thrown them on the floor behind the bed and put the pistol under the bed next to his hand. He didn't like the idea of sleeping through the night next to a sliding glass door. Joan was at her mother's. No point in taking a chance. But he did feel good. Things were happening, and he was still alive. Part of it was the absence of sex after the long naked interval in the pool. He tried to talk Joan into sneaking through the glass door into the Holiday Inn, but she turned him down. Everybody in town would know before you got the curtain pulled. It's all right to sneak around and have sex, but it has to be creditably sneaky. Ah. My place, she said. You could walk over in half an hour. I don't want you going to your place tonight. I was thinking your mother's. You'd be close, but not where you'd have a target on you. He could be waiting for us to get back to your place. Well, we're not doing anything at Mom's. So, they called it off. Hands all over each other, parked 3 blocks from Mom's, like a couple of teenagers, and he dropped her. And woke up feeling good. Maybe he could take a break from the Hook and Bullet magazines and write a piece for Vanity Fair. Violence, the new aphrodisiac. But that wouldn't be right. It had always been an aphrodisiac, as far as he could tell. Something primitive there. Maybe he thought they should have stayed in the barn for a while, up in the hayloft. When he was a teenager, there were locker room fantasy stories, maybe one or two were true, of guys getting the farmer's daughter up in the hayloft. His best friend, Otis Erickson, had claimed to have nailed one of his girl cousins, Shirley, who was in their high school class, and even in the 8th grade, had tits out to here. In what Virgil assumed was nothing more than an effort at verisimilitude, the alleged fucky warned Virgil against hay cuts, or hay rash. And you sure as shit don't want to get any hay in her crack. She'll be bitching and moaning for a week. Take a blanket. The thought that Otis Erickson might have actually gotten Shirley Erickson naked in a hayloft had, at the time, seriously turned him on. Still did, a little, though the last time he saw Shirley, she'd sort of spread out. Lying on the floor, he looked at his watch. 8 o'clock. Threw the cushions back on the couch, yawned, stretched, did his sit-ups and push-ups, cleaned up and called Davenport. Still too early, Davenport said. I was shot at last night, Virgil said. Virgil, you okay? Nothing but scared, Virgil said. The shooter wasn't that good. Scoped rifle. I was up on a friend's farm. Missed me by a couple of feet, and I wasn't moving that fast. Tell me you had your gun, Davenport said. I had the gun. So I'm running. Fired 7 shots at maybe 400 yards. Chances of hitting him were 0, but thought I should let you know. I'm pushing something here. I'm going to write some notes and email them to you, just in case. God damn it, Virgil, you take care, Davenport said. You want help? Just get me that paper that Sandy put together. On the way to breakfast, the desk clerk said, You've got mail. Fished an envelope out of a desk drawer and handed it to him. The address was typed, no return address. Mailed yesterday from Blue Stem. He went on to the dining room, holding the envelope by its edges, slid it open with a butter knife, and slid the letter out. You're barking up the wrong tree. Look at Bill Judd Jr.'s debt and think estate tax. Look at Florence Mills, Inc. That was it. No signature, of course. And the note was typed, not printed. Who'd still have a typewriter? Somebody old, like Gerald Johnstone, the funeral director. The stamp was self-sticking, so there'd be no DNA. Estate tax? Florence Mills? Sounded like something more for Sandy to do when she got back. He finished breakfast, went back to his room for his briefcase, went out to the truck, went back to the room to get his gun, back to the truck, and headed out to the Stryker farm, past the farm, around behind the hill. The far side of the hill, opposite the dell, had once been pasture land, before the countryside had emptied out, with the red quartzite right on the surface. There were clumps of wild plum and scrubby shrubs, thistle, and open spaces with knee-high grass. Virgil cruised the backside of the hill until he saw the truck tracks leading off-road. He turned off, bounced across a shallow ditch, and then ran parallel to the tracks, up the hill to a copse of trees and bushes just below the crest of the hill. The track swerved around the copse and ended. This was where the shooter had parked, out of sight from the road. He sat in the car for a minute, watching the road, and saw not another single vehicle. He was alone except for a red-tailed hawk, which circled the slope looking for voles. The hawk dropped, hit the ground, out of sight. Breakfast. Virgil stepped out of the truck and looked at the tracks made by the shooter's vehicle. There were enough weeds and grass that any tread marks were hidden. He followed one of the tracks back down the hill and never saw a clear print. Followed the other one back up, found nothing. From the car park, looking up the hill, with the sun still at his back, he could see disturbed grass where the shooter had been. He got the shotgun out of the back of the truck, loaded it alternately with buckshot and solid slugs, jacked a shell into the chamber, and followed the trail to the top of the hill. 100 yards over the crest, he could see the front lip of the pool, and the farther down the hill he went, the more of the pool he could see. The trail wasn't straight at this point. It moved between clumps of shrubs, which meant that he and Joan must have already been at the pool. Another 100 yards, and he found the shooter's stand, a circle of crushed grass next to the broken-off and rotted stump of a small tree. If he'd rested the rifle on the stump, he'd have been able to see 2/3 of the pool. To see more, he would have had to go right up to the lip of the dell, without cover. He checked around the nest. No brass. The guide cleaned up after himself. From Virgil's viewpoint, the dell down below didn't look like much. A crack in the landscape, with a wider spot and a pool near the bottom. He walked down, and when he got right on top of it, the character changed. Down here, the ground seemed to have been hit with a mammoth cleaver, carving a sharp trench right through the quartzite down to the pool. If the shooter had been cooler, or braver, he could have waited until they were fooling around under the spring, out of sight, and then walked or crawled up to the back wall. From there, he would have had them at 60 or 70 yards, and there would have been no place for Virgil and Joan to hide. On the other hand, if they'd seen him sneaking down and had gotten back to Virgil's gun and down the canyon, he'd have been screwed. In the folded, broken rocks of the canyon, a guy with a pistol could hold off a small army. On that thought, Virgil took out a cell phone. He had a signal. You might not, down in the dell, but you wouldn't know unless you were down there. Maybe the shooter had taken that into account. He could not allow somebody to see him and walk away. A lot to think about. The day would be hot again, another good day for the pool, but he wouldn't be swimming again until the killer was caught. Or dead. Virgil went back to the truck, shucked the shells out of the shotgun and put it away, and headed back to Roman Schmidt's place. Larry Jensen, Stryker's investigator, was there with the crime scene people. Virgil took Jensen aside. Where's Jim? At the office. He said you'd probably show up and want to get in. We're just about done. Let me go talk to Margot. Okay. I got a note in the mail today. I was wondering if you could check it for fingerprints. He explained and gave Jensen the note and envelope, folded into a piece of hotel writing paper. Jensen read it, frowned. Shoot, it's not a direction we've gone. Hardly had time, Virgil said. Anyway, I'm on it. I've got a researcher up in St. Paul who can pull the corporate information, and I've got some income tax forms coming in. If you could check this letter. Wonder who uses a typewriter.
Somebody Roman's age, Virgil said. Margot Carr, the crime scene specialist, showed him Schmidt's home office. A table made out of a wooden door, set across two filing cabinets. A computer, no typewriter.
Everything in here has been worked, she said.
You think the killer was in here?
No, I think the killer shot Roman, shot Gloria, then came and shot Roman twice more, then dragged him outside and propped him up with a stick he'd already cut. I don't think he went anywhere in the house, off the line of the bedroom.
Do you think he knew the inside of the house? Virgil asked.
Maybe. Or maybe Roman turned on a light in the bedroom and gave it all away.
Find anything at all?
One thing, she said. She went back to a plastic trunk, opened it, and brought back a Ziploc bag with a cigarette filter in it. Found this right by the back steps, cigarette butt. I can figure out what kind, I'm sure, but I know it's a menthol. I can smell it. Wasn't rained on, so it's recent. The Schmidts didn't smoke.
He looked at the butt, and then at Carr.
You think? I'm grasping for straws here. That's what I got.
A moment later, he was sitting at Roman's desk, his eyes closed, trying to remember. The pack of cigarettes next to George Furr's elbow when Virgil interviewed him at his house.
Salem's?
Virgil thought so. His visual image was of a green package, an aqua green. His cell phone rang. Joan.
How are you doing? She asked.
Not bad. I'm confused, but I'm looking pretty good, he said. I might go out tonight, see if I can pick up some chicks.
Good luck.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm at Schmidt's. I've got something for you to think about. How many people, once they figured we were going out to the farm, would have known how to come down that slope to a place where they'd have a free shot at us?
She thought for a moment and then said,
Well, probably not everybody.
Not everybody?
It's a fairly famous swimming hole, Virgil. Kids would park up on that hillside up in the trees, then sneak in past the stock tank and go up the canyon and skinny dip. I mean, if you didn't do that at least once in high school and get laid up on that rock, you were nobody.
How often did you do it?
He asked.
We agreed not to talk about our histories, she said.
No, we didn't.
We have now, she said.
He offered to take her to the Dairy Queen, having exhausted the fine dining possibilities at McDonald's. I'll order a pizza from Johnny, she said. My place at 4 o'clock. We'll go back out to the farm. It's a great day. Be careful. And bring a better gun.
You be careful.
Virgil dug through the Schmidt's filing cabinet, which turned out to be a waste of time. He did learn that they were fairly affluent. Gloria had been an elementary school teacher in Worthington. A friend of the alcoholic school teacher? Probably not, though. Gloria was most of a generation earlier, and would have taught in a different school. Wonder where the money came from. They had $500,000 in a Vanguard account, but then they'd had a long time to build it up. The most interesting material was in Schmidt's computer. He had a dial-up account, and he had email from Big Curly, and they were talking politics. Curly was looking for support for his son to run against Stryker in the next election. Schmidt was talking, but wasn't eager to side with someone who might be a loser. We better wait until we are close to the time, have a better idea of what the opportunities are, he wrote back in one of the notes. But he didn't say no. Sitting there, looking at the Schmidt material, Virgil started thinking about the letter he'd given to Larry Jensen. How many people knew what tree he was barking up? The banker, of course, and anyone he might have gossiped with, and the Johnstones.
That damn picture, he said aloud. Had the photograph somehow generated the note?
Stymied at the Schmidts, there was nothing right on the surface, and a full analysis of all the Schmidts' financial transactions would take a lot of time. He heard people knocking around in the back of the house and gave up. Back another day if nothing else popped up. He went out through the kitchen and saw Big Curly, Little Curly, and a deputy he didn't know standing in the yard with Jensen. He waved and said,
I'm out of here.
Anything? Jensen asked.
We need an accountant, Virgil said.
Yeah.
He'd be back to the Schmitz, Virgil thought, to see if somebody erased that email about the election. If somebody would mess with evidence at a murder scene. Be an interesting thing to know.
On the way into town, he saw another hawk circling, like the one he'd seen out at the farm, and that made him think of the shooting and the slope and the farm and skinny dipping, and the whole question of why the shooter hadn't come closer and taken the sure shot, and how he'd missed by 2 feet at 300 yards. Of course, it wasn't that hard to miss by 2 feet, but if you had the rifle sitting on a stump, the shot should have been closer than that. He thought about that for a minute and then slowed, pulled to the side of the road, and called up the Lehman place. Jesse picked up the phone.
Hello?
She did have a nice whiskey voice, Virgil decided.
This is Virgil, he said. I'm calling on behalf of Jim's sister, who's reluctant to gossip with you. But did we see you guys up in Marshall last night, about 7? We had to dodge a restaurant because she was sure it was you guys.
Not us. We went over to Sioux Falls, Jesse said.
Ah, shoot, so I ate pizza while you guys were doing surf and turf?
You pay, being a rich woman?
She laughed and said, No, I didn't. And really, why are you calling? You're sneaking up on something.
I am not, Virgil said cheerfully. Honest to God, this is nothing but the purest gossip. I personally took his beautiful sister up to the Stryker Dell late last night. You guys could have come along.
I don't think so, she said. Skinny dipping with your sister? Jim's way too straight for that.
Didn't think of that, Virgil said. I'd be too if I had a sister.
So did you have a good time?
Yes, I did. He's just like a puppy, Jesse said. But he pays attention to me.
Told you that you might like it, Virgil said. I was afraid he wasn't going to make it at all with the Schmidt case. I couldn't see how he'd be out of there before 8 o'clock, and everything around here closes up at 9.
No problem, she said. He just dumped what he was doing and came over. That's what he said, anyway. We were in Sioux Falls by 8:30.
Ah, well, so now I come to the real reason I called, Virgil said.
I knew it.
I haven't been able to catch him this morning, Virgil said.
He isn't there, is he?
Virgil?
Sorry, honey, I need to find him.
I don't sleep with guys on the first date, she said.
Not at home.
Most of the time, anyway.
Suppose that leaves something for him to look forward to, Virgil said. Don't tell him I called and asked you this, or he'd probably beat the snot out of me.
They chatted for another minute, then he closed the phone.
All right, if they'd been in Sioux Falls at 8:30, Stryker picked her up at 8 and would have been available to do the shooting.
Why?
That was another question. But knowing who was available was a step in the right direction. Though he really, really didn't think Stryker had anything to do with it. Really.
He stopped at the courthouse, found Stryker leaning in the window at the assessor's, chatting with a clerk. He straightened when he saw Virgil, and Virgil asked,
You got a minute?
Yep.
As they walked away from the assessor's desk, Stryker said,
Larry called me and said you got a letter this morning.
They went into Stryker's office and closed the door, and Virgil sat in a visitor's chair and grinned and said,
I don't know how to exactly approach this particular report.
Spit it out.
A friend of mine from here in town, Joni, and I decided to go for a swim last night, and she knew this famous local swimming hole.
Stryker's eyebrows went up.
You went skinny dipping up at the Dell with my baby sister?
Yeah.
Do any good?
Somebody with a rifle ambushed us, Virgil said.
He was watching Stryker's face, and Stryker's smile died so naturally that it seemed impossible that he already knew.
What?
2 shots, from up on that hillside. Trying to hit me, not Joni, Virgil said.
Virgil.
I hit a nerve someplace, Virgil said.
Holy shit, man.
Stryker bucked up in his chair, the wheels skittering over the plastic floor protector.
You gotta stay away from Joni until this is over.
Jesus, he could have killed both of you. Like shooting sitting ducks down in there.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out why he missed. Maybe just a bad shot, Virgil said. They talked about it for a couple of minutes, then Virgil said, They're not after Joni, whoever it is. I think I got to run down the letter from this morning. Are you looking at prints? Yeah, they're doing the glue thing right now. All right. Virgil pushed out of his chair. I got one more thing. I tell you because you're a friend. I was going through Roman Schmidt's email this morning. Big Curly was trying to get Schmidt to support Little Curly in a run against you this fall. They were talking back and forth, going over the possibilities. Stryker rubbed his chin with his forefinger. Doesn't surprise me, he said. What'd Roman have to say? He suggested that they don't do anything until they get closer to the election, see which way the wind is blowing. Didn't say no. Virgil was walking back to his car when a tall, older man in a white straw hat yelled at him.
Hey, Mr. Flowers!
Virgil waited by his truck as the man cut across the street and came up to him. He was gray-haired, weathered, wiry, in jeans and a golf shirt. I'm Andy Clay. I live up by the Johnstones. And you know where the Gleasons used to live? Yeah, how are you? Fine. Well, maybe not, Clay said. I want to tell you something, just between you and me, and maybe ask a question. No problem. I saw you at the Johnstones yesterday. Everybody in town knows who you are now, Clay said. Anyway, later on I was down at the gas station getting gas for my mower, and Carol pulls up in their Lexus truck. She doesn't even say hi. She just starts filling it up and washing the windshield, and she looks like she's in a hurry. So I went back up the hill, and I'm gassing up the mower, and here comes Carol in the Lexus. She parks in the driveway instead of the garage, and then here comes Gerald out the front door with a big bag, and he throws it in the truck. And then they both go back inside, and then they come out with a couple more bags. I'm mowing the lawn by this time, and then she locks the door, and they take off. Take off? Virgil asked. You mean like getting out of town? Unless they were donating a bunch of suitcases to the Goodwill, Clay said. The thing is, they've got these timer lights that turn the lights on and off when they're gone. Well, everybody up there knows about them, and they were going last night. One comes on here, another goes off there, then the first one goes off and the second one comes on. You know, it's almost like a signal. The Johnstones are gone. Huh, Virgil said. He thought about it for a moment and then said, So what's the question? We were talking about it last night up on the hill, Clay said. Should we all get out? Fucking Johnstones, Virgil thought as he went back to the motel. Too late to get the highway patrol to drag him back. Gerald Johnstone knew something about the picture of the dead woman, and Virgil needed to know what it was. Time for threats now, if he could find them. Didn't they say something about visiting a daughter in Minneapolis? He called Davenport. I got a couple of people who may be running. Not the killers, but they know something. If Jenkins and Schrake are sitting on their asses... He explained and told Davenport that he didn't know the daughter's name. We can probably find it in the vital records, Davenport said. I'll get the guys on it. They've been restless. Well, Jesus, don't let them beat these people up, Virgil said. These are old people. You mean we should only beat up young people? Davenport asked. There are as many old assholes as there are young ones, especially since the boomers got old. Yeah, well, I just assume my witnesses didn't die of a heart attack. Tell them to take it easy. No kicking. I thought you wanted them scared, Davenport said. A little scared, Virgil said. Not too scared. At the motel, the desk clerk had three cardboard boxes sealed with tape, stashed behind the counter. A guy brought them in a half an hour ago. He said they were from St. Paul. They felt like boxes of bricks. Virgil hauled them to his room and unloaded the stacks of paper. Too much stuff, but it had to be looked at. Some of it, anyway. Before he started on it, he called Davenport again, got a name, called a guy at the Secretary of State's office, and found that he could look at all current corporate records online, including the confidential files, if he had a password. I'll set you up with a temporary password. Chiselwit, said the guy, whose name was Martin. He spelled the password.
That'll be good through next Wednesday. If you need another one, call me up again. What's a chuzzlewit? It's a word unlikely to be figured out by some little hacker geek between now and Wednesday, Martin said. So Virgil, reluctant to start on the pile of paper, pulled out his laptop, stared at it for a moment. A problem had been pecking at the back of his mind for a day or so, and he put in the disk that Stryker had given him on the first day, the one with the paperwork on the Gleason killing. Included with everything else were a couple of hundred JPEG photographs of the crime scene. He combed over them for a half hour, then satisfied said, "Huh." No revelation, as far as he could see. Then he went online with the Secretary of State's office and searched for Florence Mills, Inc. Florence Mills, according to the information in the original filing, had been created 3 years earlier to buy, build, or lease facilities for the production of corn-based and switchgrass-based ethanol as a renewable fuel, a joint venture between Arno Partners, a limited liability company registered in Delaware, and St. John Ventures of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Not much there. He had a feeling that the Delaware company would be hard to check. Delaware was an easy place to set up a corporation, requiring minimal information, and a stickler for legal procedures when you wanted to mine their corporate records. Idaho, he thought, might be easier, and it was. Called the Idaho Secretary of State's office, was told how to look at online public records, and with a certain sense of what he'd find, looked up St. John Ventures. George Furr, Chief Executive Officer and Chairman. He called Stryker. What happened with Judge Senior's office? Did you seal it up or what? Yep. Couldn't say for sure that Junior didn't get in there, though. They're right next to each other. If there was a big pot of cash or something. I need to get in, Virgil said, right now. I'll walk down, meet you there in 10. Judd's office included a small outer waiting room with a secretary's desk, a side room with a Xerox machine, a printer, and a half dozen file cabinets.